about perhaps a few, but not in any large numbers. And he began to say that, you know, those who would survive, if they were to live through it all, if that would occur, it would only be a fragmentary, partial, tenuous kind of a protection, not a real promise, but a maybe you'll be protected. And it was quite likely at the time that he said we would be protected in our homes. We would be at home, and maybe God would sort of be with us in our homes. That is a heresy. I will prove today with God's help that it is a heresy. He was quite adamant there was no full-fledged promise of protection in a place of safety, and definitely he said no promise of literal physical removal from where we live now, you know, to some other location. I remember at the Feast of Tabernacles, I think he was about 1973-74, he very graphically described a terrified, traumatized, worldwide Church of God family, and they're in their home, and the tribulation has already come. And they're very obviously barricaded behind locked doors because they're afraid people may break in to get what they have. And, you know, they're in their living room, and as I remember, they're peeking through the curtains while their entire neighborhood sort of disintegrates all around them, and they're peeking through the curtains watching this taking place. He drew a very powerful, ghastly word picture based on his own imagination of starving neighbors, some of them dying and expiring out in their front lawns, and we're watching this occur as we look through the windows. And there are packs of rabid dogs and things of that type, and they're tearing at the bodies of our neighbors. And some of them are not yet dead. And they're literally being eaten alive. And, you know, the whole town is being reduced to rubble in the midst of a nuclear holocaust, but our house will somehow stand, like a bubble has been placed around it. And, you know, somehow through it all, the indication was we might survive. It wasn't like a promise, but we might survive, sort of peeking through the window, you know, eating our dried fruit, and hoping the neighbors, those of the neighbors who were still alive, wouldn't find out we're in there with our dried fruit and knock down the door or break the windows and sort of, you know, come rushing in and grab all that we had and maybe kill us at the same time. That was what we had to look forward to. I remember at the time thinking I'd rather be dead than survive and live in that kind of awful Dante's Inferno. I remember thinking I'd rather die than have to live through that. I really would, if that's all that's ahead. My reaction was, what kind of character could I acquire? And, you know, what kind of lessons could I possibly begin to learn? Locked in my four-bedroom tract home in Chino, California, you know, in a house untouched by the bombing and the horror, but the whole neighborhood's been literally blitzed into smithereens, and I'm in there somehow, a servant of God. You know, millions dying around me. What could I learn in that kind of an environment? Now, frankly, it was a dichotomy to me. I had for years, as a member coming into the church in the 50s, heard about the place of safety and being together and, you know, serving together and growing together someplace, and that made an awful lot of sense. But me out here and then 5 miles away, another brother in his sort of bubbled, covered house, another brother 10 miles away and no church and no services because there would be no halls left to meet and they'd all be bombed into smithereens. That didn't make any sense. Ultimately, it became sort of popular back then to laugh to scorn those who continued to believe in a literal place of safety. You were said to be petrified. And, you know, if you believe in literal location and being together, and God may be providing food and maybe even clothing and different miracles, maybe, you know, heat and air conditioning through the fire and the cloud, and supernaturally being in charge and taking us into a place that he would design and in which he would preserve us and keep us and look after us, that was considered funny. And you sort of had to go underground with that kind of a belief. I did, because it wasn't popular to state it. When the brethren would ask, and some of them still would do that, those that hadn't gotten the point that it was better not to ask, but some would still say, well, what about this place of safety idea? And we used to talk about going to Petra off in the Middle East, this city in the rocks, and then, you know, way down in Jordan. And what about that idea, Pastor? You know, new people would do this to you, because the old members all knew they should button their lip. And you sort of do a little song and dance and say, well, you know, and then you try to change the subject as fast as you could, because you had to waffle around. I knew the scriptures were there that said we would flee, but somehow we couldn't deal with them. Now, what was even more disturbing at the time was the fact that nobody in the anti-place of safety clique, and they were very influential, they're basically all gone, and I'll tell you why they've gone and what they may be doing someday, because the clique, the group, the people are still there, no longer a part of us, that believe there's no place of safety. The people in that clique never made any attempt to explain away or do any kind of meaningful exegesis of all the scriptures in the Bible that say we will go into a place of safety and we shall literally be physically removed. Now, they never went into it. I knew there had been a change, but they never told us why. It seemed to be enough. You know, I never heard Revelation 12 explained. I couldn't understand why, because it says safety there, and why wasn't it explained? Never was. Matthew 24 was never explained. Isaiah 16 was never gone into verse by verse so we could understand why we wouldn't be going into a place of safety anymore. It was deemed sufficient to laugh at the idea and sort of scoff and, you know, somehow condemn dogmatism. You mustn't be dogmatic and, you know, avoid the issue completely, beg the issue. That was how it was done. Well, I'm grateful to God that Herbert W. Armstrong was inspired a couple of years back to reinvolve himself in all facets of the work of God. And in early 1978, his involvement began to grow and grow and grow and grow. And every doctrine that had been shelved or set aside to some degree, because they were not all suppressed, but a few things, several things were, everything that had been diluted or suppressed was sort of taken back off the shelf and was looked at again and was analyzed again, was placed under clear focus, has been remagnified, and now we can openly inspire the people of God with some of the most precious promises contained within the Word of God. And they are promises, brethren, and they are clear, and they're full of hope. Now, I don't have to tell you anymore, you may end up, you know, camping out in your living room for 3.5 years. You will not camp out in your living room for 3.5 years. Now, if you try to do it, some of you will. Some of you will try that route. You will not survive the 3.5 years. During the liberal era, with this awful de-emphasis on God's power and the Spirit of God and God's help and God's guidance and all the things that God says He'll do for us, and that was also to de-emphasize, people began to feel protection was sort of in their own hands. So if you wanted to be protected, you had to do something yourself to be protected, because obviously we weren't going into a place of safety. So people began to build bomb shelters. You know how many members built bomb shelters across the USA in their basement? About 30 at last report, quite a number. And because they had to create, you see, their own place of safety, God wasn't going to give them one. They had to create in their home their own. We had people filling their garage with wheat, like, you know, the Mormons do, bags of wheat like they do, and then big jugs of sparklets. Some people still have so many jugs of sparklets in the garage it isn't even funny. And, you know, you can drink it, it's okay, but, you know, half the garage full of it and all that type of thing. Because people felt survival depended on them. So if survival depends on you, buy a lot of sparklets. I mean, you know, get with it. Do something. I ever tell you about the member in England who is a real member who bought himself a house trailer a couple of years ago and proceeded to fill the house trailer because his house was already full, proceeded to fill the house trailer from the floor to the roof with sacks full of flour and then crates full of what the British would call tinned goods or canned goods of all kinds, you know, all kinds of things in cans so he would have food to eat. And, of course, not sparklets because it doesn't exist over there, but gallons of bottled water of different kinds and everything like that. And he also had several sacks of chlorine because, you know, the survival people tell you that if you want to survive all of this that's ahead of us, water will last a couple of years, but even bottled water will finally get the fungus in it. When the fungus gets in it, you got to have the chlorine to repurify your bottled water. So he had sacks of chlorine in there with the wheat and the water and all the rest of it. And he so jam-packed the house trailer with all of his stuff, it was in his backyard, that ultimately, you see, floor to ceiling, the floor of the house trailer caved in. And when the floor, I mean, this is heavy stuff, this is survival paraphernalia. When the floor caved in, the grain all spilled out, but so did the chlorine and the grain got all mixed together, and so much for his grain. You know, I mean, grain and chlorine don't really make a very good marriage. And he lost most of what he had. And I guess it was a sad, sad day. I assume he saved his water if the bottles didn't break when the floor fell in. Now, the point is this. Ted would have you believe that teaching that the people of God will be preserved in a literal place of safety, that makes people survival-oriented and gets people hung up on, you know, circumstances, physical circumstances, places and food and things. And that's too physical. Destroys faith, he used to say. But if you teach people there is no place of safety, and you stress that maybe you'll be protected in your living room, maybe, well, then he said, or indicated, that people would get more spiritually oriented, have more faith in God, have more confidence in God, and everything would be so much better, he claimed. You know what happened? Just the opposite occurred. And his doctrine built an unbelievable fear reaction in so many members who expected to die. When you expect to die as a martyr, you will have automatically a fear reaction for a while. It destroyed faith in God. And you know, the truth makes you free. When you understand the truth about the place of safety, that will free you from a lot of anxieties and enable you as a result to have more faith in God, because God does it, not us. God does it anyway. No matter where we go, God will do it and protect us there. It increases faith in God and love for God and confidence in God. His doctrine did quite the opposite. And I want you to turn to the book of Revelation chapter 12, and we'll notice the promise there of physical removal. Not of being protected in our homes. He promised a physical removal. This was never explained when that other doctrine was going on. Never was explained because it refutes it. And we'll see in a minute that some will not accept that promise of protection. Some will not want to flee. Some do not want to flee now. Not everybody who believes they'll be, you know, protected in their homes has left and gone with Ted. Some have stayed with that idea. There's a pointed warning to them, because that idea is going to come back as time goes on. You'll see it and you'll hear it. It'll come back. God says so. Revelation chapter 12, verse 10. I heard a loud voice in heaven, and the voice said, "Now has come salvation." It's a prophecy for the end of the age, strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser, the criticizer of the brethren, the one who maligns the people of God, is cast down, that accuses them before our God night and day. And of course, a lot of that accusation comes through the media and through government sources and that type of thing. Satan doesn't accuse us, you know, himself with his own voice. He works through government and he works through the media. And that is happening more and more, and we're being accused. And they overcame him. Verse 12, "Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and you that dwell within them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down unto you, having great wrath," not a little, but a lot, "because he knows he has but a short time. And when the dragon saw he was cast into the earth, he began to persecute," that means he began to harass and to malign and to, you know, bully the woman, again through the usual sources, through government, and in our age, because this is a modern time, through the media. That's begun to happen more than ever before. Now what happens as the persecution grows and escalates? Verse 14, "To the woman were given two wings out a big bird." Now what does that mean? You know, is that big bird on TV, the big yellow bird, and we sort of fly off on the wings of a big yellow speckled bird, as the evangelicals say. They have this crazy hymn about the big speckled bird. You former Baptists know what I mean. And is that what God is talking about? This, you know, a literal giant bird, and we all clamber up on the back of this huge bird, and we fly off to glory. That isn't really what God means, but he does mean something specific. It's symbolic. Two wings of a great eagle. And there are only two and a half places in the Bible where that symbolism is used. One is Exodus 19, one is Deuteronomy 32, and that symbolism, you see, is used in both of those locations to picture the literal removal of an entire nation. I mean, a large number of human beings, a removal of those people geographically from one location on earth into another location on earth, from one country into another country. It pictures that removal in a supernatural way. Turn to the book of Exodus chapter 19. And you'll see what it says, and you'll see the focus. That bird is going to be there, but it's a symbolic bird, and what does it picture? Chapter 19, this is what it's always pictured, and Revelation 12 is obviously referring back to this type of thing. In the third month, chapter 19, Israel was about to leave Egypt, and they were gone forth out of the land of Egypt. They left one country, and they went into another country. They went into the Sinai Peninsula. The same day, they came into the wilderness of the Sinai. Now, we know that, you know, we used to talk about Petra being the place of safety, and it's in that same wilderness, which is sort of interesting. Is that significant that Petra, which Ted has laughed at a lot, and those who've gone with him laugh at continually. A couple weeks ago, a member got a little letter from their group, and again, it was making light of the place of safety in Petra, and poor Mr. Armstrong still believes in that. So they've not really changed in those areas. What about Petra? Did you know that there is a little river that's usually dry during the year that runs through Petra? It only has water in it during the rainy season. And there is a rainy season, by the way. Some of you didn't know that, but there is one. From October through March, it rains in Petra. It rains in the Sinai. And the desert sort of blooms for a while. And this little river, dry half the year and runs half the year, is called the Wadi Musa, or the Wadi Musa. The Arabs call it that in Arabic. The Bedouins use that name. And it means the stream or the river of Moses. And that runs right through the middle of Petra. Now, why would there be a little river running through the middle of that city off in the Middle East called the Stream of Moses if Moses never went there? Well, I think Moses went there. In fact, during the 40 years, I think Moses and the Israelites went there a great deal. I think that is provable. They came into the wilderness of Sinai. Now, in the wilderness of Sinai, there was an area that corresponds to the modern-day Petra. Is it significant that the Arabs have traditions of Moses and the Israelites going through Petra, being in that area? It certainly is in the same area. They had to stumble on it at least a few times. They left Rephidim, which was in Egypt, and they were led to the desert of Sinai, and they had pitched in the wilderness, and they camped before the mountain. Moses went up on the mountain to talk to God. Verse 4, God said this. They were in this new country, and God said, "Have you seen what I did unto the Egyptians? How I bore you on the wings of an eagle, and I brought you into this wilderness unto myself. I got you out of Egypt. I brought you here. I did it on eagle's wings." I see. Do you understand what that means? Turn to the book of Deuteronomy chapter 32, another example of use of that symbolism of a bird flying, and yet they walked. They didn't take an airplane. There were no airplanes to take. But flying upon the wings of an eagle was symbolic of their march out of Egypt through the Red Sea into Sinai. Deuteronomy 32, verse 10, another context, talks about eagle's wings. Talks about the Israelites. God found them, verse 10, in a desert land. Well, it doesn't mean he found them for the first time, but he began to work with them there in a more of a specific, direct way. And they were in the waste, howling wilderness. It was quite a rough place. This wasn't Disneyland. It says it was a waste, howling wilderness. Would you like to spend a couple of years in a waste, howling wilderness? Does that sound appealing to you? Doesn't sound appealing to me at all. You want to go to Petra? You want to go into a waste, howling wilderness? I hope you do, if that's where God wants you to go, because it may be where God wants you to go. He took them into a waste, howling wilderness. Could he take us into the same place? Notice what he did. He led him about. Now, what does that mean? It says in the margin, he encompassed him with angels. He blessed them. He led them about that wilderness, back and forth, led them around. What is, what's that got to do with the price of putty? He instructed them. He kept them as the apple of his eye. Verse 11, there's an analogy here. As, you see, in all of that, he was working with them as an eagle stirs up her nest and flutters over her young and spreads abroad her wings. And then she takes them when danger comes. When danger is imminent, she will take them, the little eaglets who cannot yet fly, and danger is there. They will get up on her wings, and she will bear them on her wings, and she will fly to a place of safety away from imminent danger. Now, the little eagles may not be able to fly yet. This is the symbolism, you see, but they've got those sharp little claws. And they can get up on her wings when she sees a man coming, you see, to maybe steal the baby eaglets. And they can get those little claws and dig them into the bones on the wings of the mother eagle. Just dig in those little claws. And once they're in, they're in. And she can get up, and even moving her wings up and down, the little eaglets will, hang on for dear life. And she'll fly and take them to another location and to safety. And that literally occurs among certain species of eagles. That literally happens. And God says that symbolism of an eagle with the baby eaglets clutching, with their little tiny claws hanging onto her wings is a picture of something, verse 12. So, again, the analogy, the Lord alone led Israel in that howling, horrible, waste wilderness. That's the symbol of eagle's wings. Symbolizes many things. You can notice verse 13. Symbolizes even miraculous feeding and guidance. He made them ride in the high places of the earth and the mountains. Part of that wilderness was mountainous. They might eat the increase of the fields, and he made them to suck honey out of the rock and all of the flinty rock, and they were given water out of a rock miraculously, and so it goes. Now, built within, you see, this promise of protection and this symbolism of flying upon the wings of an eagle are many things. There is protection in one part of the world from a time of trouble in another part of the world. There is a promise of removal into a wilderness, because this is what occurred on that occasion. There is supernatural promise of food being given. God says he is like a great eagle, you see, upon whose wings the people of God can stand and hang on, and he will take them into another location. Revelation 12. Now, that doesn't describe sitting in the nest while those who would kill the baby eaglets climb up and grab them and maybe strangle them. They're taken away. Verse 14, are we to be taken away? To the woman, verse 14, we're given two wings of a great eagle. The same symbolism. She might fly into the wilderness, not a wilderness or any wilderness, but the wilderness, you see. The wilderness, it seems to refer to, you know, a wilderness that they all knew about. Could we be flying into the exact same wilderness into which the Israelites once flew on the wings of a symbolic eagle as well? Into her place. Not her places, but her place singular. It indicates possession. It indicates, in effect, a literal location. It indicates a designed, a custom, prepared location that God has set aside, and God has built into that location everything that will be necessary, you see, for life and growth and change. Into her place where she is nourished. That's passive. She's going to be nourished, fed. For a time, that's a year, and times 2 years, and half a time, that's half a year from the face of the serpent. And that serpent, the devil, is going to cast out of his mouth water, which is a type of armies. And armies are going to be sent after the woman, you see. This is government harassment of the people of God, even as we prepare and as we literally flee. But sometimes people have said, oh, they're going to throw us out. They may throw us out of the country. We'll leave when they throw us out. Reverend, it says right here, they're going to try to stop it. They're going to try to bring us back. They'll be so upset when we leave. They will do everything in their power to stop the flight of the people of God. Water is a type of water is a type of armies. And armies will be sent by Satan, you know. And again, this is describing governmental involvement. I cause her to be carried away, brought back, perhaps imprisoned by the representative of a certain country, nation, or state. And the earth will help the woman. Probably an earthquake, and the earth will open up her mouth and swallow up the flood, the armies, which the dragon sends out of his mouth. That is one of many earthquakes described in the Bible. I don't know which one that is. But there'll be a monstrous earthquake someplace between us and those armies, and they'll be cut off. I don't know. Maybe it'll, you know, be right here. The San Andreas Fault is pretty scary. I don't live far from it. And we have members living a few hundred feet away from that fault. And, you know, people talk about California falling into the sea. Who knows? I mean, maybe California will someday. I don't mean that in a jocular way. It would be a sad thing. But who has persecuted us the most? What part of, you know, who has Satan used the most? So far, the state of California. And this is where the great monstrous earthquake, the biggest one, they say, in the history of the USA, may someday let loose. I don't know what it means exactly, but there's going to be a time when we're protected, and the earth will open up her mouth and swallow up the flood and the dry that the dragon sent out. Now, the dragon, that Satan, was wrath with the woman. Now he's thwarted, you see, so he goes back. He goes back to where the woman was. He goes back to that location geographically in which the woman once lived. And what does he find when he gets back there? He finds the remnant of her seed. He finds people still at home. He finds people who said, I won't go. He finds people who said, I won't flee. He finds people who said, God will protect us in our own homes. He goes back and he finds a remnant in their homes. And these aren't unconverted people, brethren. Notice, they keep the commandments of God, and they have the testimony, the truth, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he goes back to persecute them, and they will die as martyrs in their homes. What about Ted and his idea? Is something, in a sense, being prepared? Is there a controversy in the worldwide church of God? Not anymore, not to any great degree. There was a couple of years back. Seems it may come again in some way. Now, we need to understand the rationale behind those who say, I won't go, because some will not, and they'll be right here, you see. They're being described. Satan finds them in their homes and communities and towns. I tend to think the anti-place of safety clique or clique may again make its appearance. That's possible someday. Maybe Ted's group will become very vocal about their beliefs. They have, of late, begun to talk again about, you know, Mr. Herbert Armstrong and his silly place of safety idea. And some of the brethren may have doubts. Some of you possibly have doubts on whether we go or whether we don't. And you know what? One other thing. Even as we prepare to flee, I can easily anticipate some unconverted relations calling up the newspapers, because we'll have several weeks. And the Bible indicates that, to get ready. It won't sort of happen, boom. We'll have time to prepare certain things. And there will be headlines very likely connecting us with this satanic Jim Jones compound and the cult that he had. and they'll compare us to them, and it'll be very embarrassing. It'll be hard to take, and there may even be headlines, especially here in Southern California, where we have so many members and where we have the college and where we're well known. So that's going to create some problems. In Revelation 12, remember, verse 15 says that there'll be a concerted, organized attempt on the governmental level to prevent and to stop the flight. And some of our brethren are going to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm not going to be a part of that. There'll be pressure not to flee. There'll be pressure not to go. There'll be pressure to keep on representing God in our home and in our community, and people will be saying, hey, there's got to be a witness back here. God will protect us. You just can't go off and sell your house and sell your car and, you know, give up your job and leave the dog at home by himself and forget about the rabbit and the gerbil or whatever their gerbil, anyway, whatever that animal is. Never had to figure out how to pronounce that. Gerbil, I guess it is. And you can't haul your kids out of school and hey, wait a minute, maybe Ted was right. I didn't expect this, all this publicity. You know, maybe we're going to be, we can be protected in our homes. Well, sure. That's what some will say. The seeds are already sown for a to flee or not to flee controversy. Ted began it. Somehow it may begin to roll again. I know what Mr. Herbert Armstrong is going to say. He will say flee, because that is what Scripture says. Somebody else may say something else. There'll be pressure there, and there'll be anti-flight bias. Luke chapter 17, I want to show you a little bit about that kind of a bias, and we'll see what we should understand about Lot's wife. You know who Lot's wife was? She was a lady that didn't want to flee. Did you know that? She was a lady who didn't want to flee. In fact, she turned around so she could go back home, and her husband had to flee, finish his flight alone without his wife. His wife. There's a lesson in the experience of Lot's wife. She became a pillar of salt for you and I in the end of the age. And that pillar stands tall, brethren. Someday I'm going to tell you a week or a month or 6 months before that flight takes place, you better remember Lot's wife. And some will remember and some will forget. What do you have to remember about the wife of Lot? We'll see in a minute. Luke 17, verse 26. As it was in the days of Noah, not during the flood, but before the flood, not during it, mind you, before it. Before the flood came. So shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man, before the flood, the tribulation, comes again. This is not talking about the last week before Jesus returns. It's talking about the last few months before the flood comes, before tribulation comes, before we flee. What will it be like in the days as we prepare for the final flight? Verse 27. As Moses built the ark, which was a place of safety, remember that? He had a place of safety. He was building it, and he was talking about it, and they saw the ark eating and the drinking. Not during the flood. They were dead during the flood. Until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And then the flood came on the world and destroyed them all. And brethren, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days, longer period, not the week when he returns, but the days, 3, 4, 5, 7, 10, 15 years before the Son of Man comes. Notice verse 28. Likewise also as it was in the days of Lot. When was that? After Sodom was burned? No. Before Sodom was destroyed. As God was working, you see, with Lot and persuading Lot that he must flee, and Lot was preaching to some of his relations and friends and saying, God is going to protect us and preserve us, the others around them kept on eating, verse 28, and drinking and buying and selling and planting and building and living there, and they weren't affected by his warnings at all. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, he fled, he arrived in Zoar, that same day, as soon as he arrived, he walked in the, you know, in the gates of the little town called Zoar, which was the place of safety then it rained fire from heaven and it destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the days when the Son of Man is about to be revealed, but not the week of his return, several years before he comes, as we're preparing the ark, as we're preparing to leave, as we're doing what Noah did and what Lot did. And we apply this to the return of Jesus Christ. It isn't describing his return. It's referring to the way of life of people and the reaction of people and the attitude of people toward fleeing and the place of safety. And some are going to say, I won't go. Some are going to say, hey, give up my house? What about this bad publicity and the Middle East? Are you kidding? Ted says we may be protected in our homes. What about that doctrine? What about that idea? Well, maybe we should turn over to the book of Genesis chapter 19 and see what actually happened in the days of Lot. Genesis chapter 19. It'll be this way in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. Not during the tribulation, before it. Not during the destruction of Sodom, before it. And Genesis 19, verse 12, what occurred? Well, the city was about to be destroyed, and the men said unto Lot in verse 12, have you here anyone besides yourself? Do you have son-in-laws, and do you have sons and daughters? Verse 12, they're describing, you see, safety. And whatever you have in the city, bring them out of this place. That was a command. For we will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxing great before the face of God, and God has sent us to destroy this city. And Lot went out, and he spoke to his sons-in-law that married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord God will destroy this city. He didn't say, stay in town, stay where you are, pray to God, and say, Father, protect us in Sodom. Lead us here. We don't have to flee. We have trust in you. Protect us in the city. He didn't say that. He said, get out. But his sons-in-law looked at him, and he seemed like somebody who was mocking. They thought he was daft. How could God destroy a whole city? God wouldn't do that. God wouldn't do that, the sons-in-law said. So the sons-in-law didn't believe, you see. As it was in the days of Noah and the days of Lot, so shall it be, brethren, in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. They didn't believe. When the morning came, verse 15, the angels hastened Lot and said, arise and get out, lest you be consumed in the city. Verse 16, and while Lot lingered, because you see, he was attached to the city, and there was a lot of publicity going on, all the neighbors were talking about it, and he had certain lingering doubts, and he wasn't exactly sure that God really was going to do this. There were questions in his mind, heavy questions about fleeing. He lingered. And as it was in the days of Lot, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. And the angels laid a hold upon him, and they dragged him out. Came to pass, verse 17, when they brought him forth, that he said, finally he got the picture, he said, escape for your life. Look not behind you. Don't stay in the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest you be consumed. And Lot said unto them, oh, not so, my Lord. Uh-huh. He said, I'm not going to go to the mountain. You know why? Verse 19, behold, now your servant has found grace in your sight, and you've magnified your mercy, which you've shown unto me in saving my life. But I don't want to go to the place of safety in the mountain, because you see, some evil up in that remote, inhospitable mountain may take me, and I'll die up there. Oh. I remember being laughed at by some ministers who are gone now, and I said, I believe that we would go to Petra someday. And they said, ha! Petra's got no water. Petra's got no food. Petra's called the city of the dead. You want to go to Petra? You'll die up there in that forsaken mountain. I can't escape to that mountain lest some evil take me and I die there. As it was in the days of Lot, so shall it be again in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. So the story of Lot is about escape into a place of safety, not Christianity per se. Behold, now he argued about even the city. He didn't want to go up in the mountain, so God did change it. They didn't have to flee quite as far. He went to Zoar instead. Verse 22, hasten you, escape thither, he said. I cannot do anything until you become thither. Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar. That was the place of safety then. The city was risen upon the earth, and finally Lot entered into Zoar. He got there. And then the Lord God rained down upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire, and overthrew the cities and the plain and the inhabitants and everything which grew upon the ground. Now here's a flashback. A couple of miles before they arrived, you know, they were still traveling. This is a flashback. Lot's wife, who wasn't so sure she wanted to go into this place of safety, who liked Sodom, who maybe thought, well, God will protect me back in Sodom, she looked back, and brethren, she wasn't just looking back. She was about to turn all the way around, and she was going to go back. She wasn't looking back longingly. She was going to turn around and she was going to march back into her city. That was her town. She wanted nothing to do with this place of safety idea. She turned around and she became a pillar of salt that is a memorial. Not for them. For us. You know what the memorial of Lot's wife standing there in that desert, a pillar of salt, means? It's a lesson for us. It means when the call comes to flee, and the directive is given, brethren, we must go. We must not linger as Lot did. We must not turn back around as his wife did. We must go all the way. We mustn't stay in the land or in the city or give in to some kind of anti-place of safety bias or reject the promise of literal physical removal. Notice Luke 17, verse 28. Luke 17, verse 28. Lesson in Lot's wife we need to understand. Remember verse 29. Verse 28, as it was in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank. His sons-in-law wouldn't leave the town with him. They just kept on living as they'd always lived. But the same day, verse 29, that Lot went out of Sodom and got the Zoar. His wife didn't make it, but he did. He rained fire and brimstone, and it destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the days when the Son of Man comes. Now, does that mean, you know, in a couple of years? Well, what does it mean? Verse 31, in that day, does this mean the day of Christ's return? He which is on the housetop in that day, and his stuff is in the house. His stuff is in the house. I think that's sort of funny. I find that humorous. His stuff is in the house. I don't think that word is used anyplace else in the Bible. All his stuff is in the house. He's got some big, huge, I guess he's got his suitcase already, and he's got his hi-fi, and I don't know what else he's got in his house. All his stuff is in there. And it says he wants to come down off of his roof and grab the suitcase and get his stuff. Don't come down to get your stuff. Now, you know, some of our brethren apply that to the return of Jesus Christ. Does that make any sense? You know, you're up on the roof, your suitcase is in the house, your stuff is in there, Jesus is coming in clouds, you see him coming, you say, wait a minute, you jump off the roof, you run in the house, you grab your suitcase, and you say, here I am, Lord. Now, you know none of you would do that. You would know full well you would rise in the clouds and go up to meet him directly from the roof. There'd be no question of going to get your stuff in your house. Now, when would you want to jump off the roof and go grab the suitcase? It's so pitifully clear, brethren. This is referring to the example of Lot and the example of Noah and the ark and fleeing into a place of safety. Don't come down to grab the suitcase. If you're in the field, don't return back to get your stuff. And as you're doing that, as you're going through the trauma of leaving, he says, verse 32, please, brethren, remember Lot's wife. Remember the wife of Lot and what happened to her and why. She became a pillar of salt on the way to a place of safety because she was turning around and she was going to go back. Remember Lot's wife. Some of you will forget what Lot's wife did. A lot of people have forgotten who have left the church of God. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it. Those who seek to lose their lives will preserve it. I tell you, in that night, the night of Christ's return, no. In that night, there shall be two men in one bed. One shall be taken up in clouds to meet Jesus, no. Into a place of safety. Now, you can use this as a kind of a type of what may happen when Jesus returns, but the context is not discussing that. Two women will be grinding together. One shall be taken, the other left. Two men will be in the field, the other one taken, the other left. And they answered and said, well, where? Or where are they going to be taken? You see, they knew this wasn't Christ's return. And he said unto them, wherever the body is, wherever the church is, there will the eagles, interesting symbolism, there will all the eagles be gathered together. Wherever the body is, we'll all be together. It describes unity. And there's a clear promise there of protection. I want you to turn to Revelation chapter 3, and we'll just sort of zero in very quickly on some of those promises. And let's burn some of these things into our minds and learn the lesson of Lot's wife and learn not to make the same hideous, awful, ghastly mistake that she made. So many people are going to make that mistake, God says. And Satan knows it, and Satan is preparing to do what he will have to do because of it. Chapter 3, verse 10. Because you kept the word of my patience, I'll keep you from the hour of trial. Notice that. You kept the word of perseverance, patience. I will keep you from. The Greek word is ek and means out of. Away from. What? The hour of the trial, not the hour of trial in general, not human day-by-day trials and problems and sicknesses and all of that, because those things we do have to go through. We'll be kept out of, away from the hour of the trial. Which one? Which shall come upon all the world. Not just some of the world, but all the world. This is worldwide trial. No other way you can look at this. This is worldwide conflagration. To try those that come upon the earth when? Behold, I come quickly. That's in the days of the return of Jesus Christ. Isaiah chapter 26 is another example of this. A general promise. We'll get more specific in a minute. Isaiah chapter 26. Notice he talks about a literal physical removal. Isaiah 26, verse 21 talks about worldwide tribulation. You can read that later. God is going to come out of his place, Isaiah 26, verse 21, to punish the inhabitants of the earth, the whole world. It's worldwide tribulation. What does he say to us in verse 20? Come, my people, God's people, enter you into your chambers. That's an enclosed location. And shut the doors about you. Remember, God said he shut the doors of the ark? He shut them and nobody could get in. Again, doors are going to be shut. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment until the indignation be passed. Now, how can you hide in your own house? Ever tried to hide in your own house? I haven't. It never did seem to work. Halloween evening, sometimes we've hidden in the kitchen. We've learned over the years it's better to go someplace else than to get out of the house. The kids always seem to know you're there. Ever tried to hide when the Jehovah's Witnesses knock at the door? You know, you don't want to answer, but they always come by with these sweet little children nowadays to get you to open the door. And ever sat in the kitchen when Uncle George came by that you owe $25 to and you really don't want to see him? And you tell the kids to shut up, you know, don't talk. Everyone is sitting there, not moving, the lights are out. And you grab the dog and you're holding his muzzle shut so he doesn't bark. And you're saying to the kids, shh, shh, shh. The kids are trying not to laugh. You've never done that kind of evil thing, have you? Maybe some of you have. But the unwanted guest keeps on ringing. He rings and rings because he knows you're there. You see, he knows you're there. It's obvious your car's in the driveway, dummy. You didn't, you know. He knows you're there. And there's smoke curling out of the chimney. And there's no mail in the... He goes and checks the mailbox. No mail. He knows you're taking the mail in. He knows you're home. Now, if God did protect you in your home, how could you hide? It says we're going to have to hide. How can you hide in your own house? If God is protecting you miraculously in your own house, and the world is falling apart around you, and you've got some food, and you've got some water, and it's 130 degrees outside because the earth is going to be brought closer to the sun, you see, and temperatures will be going up 10, 20, 30 degrees higher than they are now in the daytime and at night. And it's 130 degrees Fahrenheit in Southern California in the day, and 110 real cool at night. But you've got air conditioning, you see. I mean, God is blowing cool air into your house. Because you can't go out. You don't dare go out. You're in there in the air conditioning. You think you can hide that from your neighbors? You'd be famous all over the L.A. Basin if you had food and air conditioning and all those things. You'd have the weak and the dying lining up in front of your house every morning begging for food, saying, I want some of what you've got. You'd have the elderly with the heat prostration banging on your door saying, let me in. I can't survive this 140-degree heat any longer. We know it's cool where you are. We know it's cool in there because you never come out. You got something that we don't have. And if you said no, they'd burn the house down. They'd break the windows in. They'd get in there somehow, these starving, dying, sick human beings, to get what you have got. You couldn't hide. And God says, we're going to hide for a little moment until the indignation be passed. Now, where? Everybody always wants to know where. You want me to tell you where? I can't tell you exactly where, but I can tell you sort of exactly where. It is a little uncertain, not all that uncertain, I don't think, but a little uncertain, which helps to generate faith and is good for our faith. And I'm not going to be categorical today, but I think we can come to some interesting possible conclusions about where conclusions we need to analyze. And in doing this, I'm not trying to tell you the exact location for sure. I am trying to magnify the fact there is a location, and God gives some identifying signs. And you put all those signs together, you do come up with basically, would you believe it, one place. But I can get off the stick because I could say, well, maybe that one location is a type. Maybe it's all antithetical of someplace else. I don't think it is, but maybe it is. I don't think it is, but we'll see. Remember in Revelation... That much we do know. And the wilderness in Greek means a deserted, desolate place. Does Los Angeles County fit that picture? There are locations that are desolate. There are no locations that are deserted, you see. We got too many human beings here for Los Angeles County to be called a wilderness. How about up in the high desert? Are we all going to go up to Victorville? I mean, up there it's sort of desolate, to say the least. But, you know, people are moving up to Victorville by the thousands every month because they got all the cheap housing and people want to drive all the way from Victorville, which is south of Barstow, down into Orange County to work because the same house up in Victorville that cost $45,000 cost $200,000 in Garden Grove without the crime and without the smog. Now, Victorville isn't the place of safety. We couldn't hide 100,000 members in Victorville. We got enough trouble hiding the 25 members we already got up there, you see. They keep the whole place stirred up all the time as it is. So, no, it isn't going to be Victorville. Before he left the church many years back, Dr. Ernest Martin postulated that the place of safety might be in Switzerland, up in the Alps. And he was quite serious about that. You know, I've been to Switzerland, and it is not desolate. They got all that snow up there. There are beautiful streams. It is green. It is not a wilderness, a howling wilderness. Switzerland is not. It is not deserted. Those hardy Swiss live all over those mountains. They live every place. And, you know, the villages hang off the sides of some of the most unbelievable peaks. They even have to be little narrow gauge railways to get up to the top of some of those mountains because they can't even build roads to get up there. It's so high. But the Swiss will build little tiny railways and somehow get up there and live there. And if you can find a square mile of Switzerland that somebody is not already living in, you're a better man than I am because I've tried. It is not desolate. It is not a wilderness. It is not deserted. And as nice as Switzerland might be for the place of safety, all those mountains and caves and greenery, it's not going to be Switzerland. And as nice as Switzerland might be for the place of safety, all those mountains and caves and greenery, it's not going to be Switzerland. Now, Revelation 12 is talking about a desert-style wilderness. That's pretty clear. No other place would be that inhospitable and that desolate and that deserted. Now, we know it's got to be a kind of a wilderness. It's got to be a kind of a desert, but where? How about the Navajo Desert over in Arizona? It is deserted there. Get the other side of Kingman and around Gallup, and I mean, it's like the end of the world, unless you really like that kind of desert, which I do not. And, you know, Round Rock, up way, way up in the Navajo Reservation, it is really deserted and desolate. Is that where we're going to go? Well, the Bible says no, because the Navajo are the wrong race. You see, the Bible says that we're going to be protected on Arab land, not an Indian land. It's got to be an Arab country, and there got to be Bedouins there. And if there are no Bedouins there, if there are no Bedouins there at all, it is not where the place of safety is going to be located, because there got to be Bedouins there. There have to be Bedouins. I'll show you that in a minute. And it's got to be within a day's driving or flying distance of the city of Jerusalem. And that we can also prove. Now that eliminates Kingman and Gallup. Because even if you take the best El Al jet from Jerusalem and you fly madly to New York and across to Chicago and down to Where else, maybe Tucson or Phoenix, and then you drive madly up to Kingman, you'll still take you a day and a half. And the Bible says less than a day to make the trip from Jerusalem to the place of safety. Actually, from Jerusalem across the Allenby Bridge to the east and across the West Bank and up to Amman and then down the Amman Petra Highway is about 3.5 hours by car, maybe 4 if you have a slow car. And that's about how long it's going to take, God. It says Matthew chapter 24. We'll zoom through some of this very quickly. Matthew chapter 24. It's going to have to be an Arab land and within a day's drive of Jerusalem. That's clear in Matthew chapter 24, verse 14. Notice what it says. And I'll show you one of the signs of our leaving for the place of safety, but it's the final sign. There are going to be 2 signs, by the way, that it's time to leave. Really, it is 1 sign in 2 stages. And we'll be shown 1 sign several weeks before the deadline, and then there'll be a 2nd sign the day of the deadline. Sort of interesting. So it's 1 sign in 2 facets, and I'll try to explain those in a few minutes. Verse 14. Now the world for a witness unto all nations, then shall the end come. Now verse 15 says, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel, stand in the holy place. So that is the desecration of a Jewish place of worship. I'll talk about that someday. In the city of Jerusalem, and Europeans are going to desecrate that place of worship. It's a European combine that will do it. When that occurs, verse 14, then let the brethren that still happen to be in Judea, not elsewhere, the others will already have gone. It'll be too late if you wait until that happens. You won't have time to get there, because that happens the day when the place of safety is closed to new arrivals. That's the 2nd sign, and the 2nd sign is only to those in Judea. We'll already have fled. Maybe some of us will be there in Judea that day. Others may already be in the place of safety. Then let those that be in Judea flee into the mountains. Now, why do I say they only have a day? It's very clear. That sign, Daniel chapter 12 tells us, occurs 1,260 days. When that temple is desecrated, before Jesus Christ comes, that's 3.5 years. The book of Revelation chapter 11 says the 2 witnesses do their work for 1,260 days in Jerusalem. That's interesting. The book of Revelation 12 makes it very clear that we will be in the place of safety. We will be there 1,260 days.
And yet the final sign to see, the final sign to flee, you see, occurs 1,260 days, but that's the period of time we're supposed to be there. You see how it all comes together? That's the last day these people are down in Jerusalem, and they're right there, the deadline day. And they got a few hours to get out of town and to flee into the place of safety. Most of the others of us will long since have made that trip. Of course, we may all be there that day. I don't know. Helping the two witnesses set up their work and getting Jerusalem ready for them. If you're in Judea, that day you flee. And once again, the time setting is pinpointed. Don't come out of the housetop and come down and take something out of the house. If you're off in the field, don't race back to get your clothes, because you'll have no time to do all of that if you're in Jerusalem. Time is going to be at a premium. You'll have a few hours to make it before the days of that city of refuge, the doors, literally close. Woe unto them, verse 19, that are defiled, and to those that give suck in those days. Pray that your flight be not in the winter or on the Sabbath day, for then shall be great tribulation worldwide, and we'll be protected from it once the flight has taken place. Now, I want to show you it's not in Jewish soil. It is near Jerusalem, but it is not in Jewish soil. I'll also show you, you can see Jewish soil from the place of safety, though. You can literally see the land of the Jews from the heights where the place of safety is located. God says, wherever you go into safety, make sure there are mountains there, and you can climb those mountains. It'll be on Arab land, and you can look from the mountains off in the distance, and you will see the land of promise stretching out before your eyes, but you will not be in the land of promise. Now, that sort of narrows things down, doesn't it? I don't think Switzerland fills the bill. I don't think L.A. County is that place. Daniel 11, verse 40, God says he will supernaturally protect a piece of Arab real estate for 3 years, not 3.5. We'll be in place of safety 3.5 years, but this one country that is an Arab nation, we protect it for 3 of those years, but not for the last 6 months. Daniel chapter 11, verse 40. The king of this nation that is described here is King Hussein of Jordan. God is describing the basic limitations of a little Arab country that is across the river Jordan from the nation of Israel. You go east from Israel, you come into the nation of Jordan. And it's a little Arab country. It's been there as long as Israel has been there, only a couple of decades. But it is there. And in that nation, 3,000 years ago, 3 tiny peoples dwelled. Those 3 tiny people, some of them are still there, some of them are not. But the nation, the area in which those peoples live, is going to be protected by God for 3 years. Why? I think you'll see in a minute. Verse 40 of Daniel 11. At the time of the end, shall the king of the south, the leader of an Arab combine, push at him and the king of the north. This is the leader of this European resurrected Holy Roman Empire. Shall come against this Arab ruler and begin to destroy Arab countries. Verse 41, he shall enter into the glorious land. Now, Israel is not... The Jews do not have an Arab land in a sense, but they're surrounded by Arabs. And many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, out of that attack, even Edom. And Edom was in the, was, no longer is, but used to inhabit what is now the southern end of the nation of Jordan. Please remember that. They lived in the southern end of what is now Jordan in the Sinai. And Moab used to live in the central part of what is now Jordan. And the chief of the children of Ammon lived in the northern part of what is now Jordan, and most of them still do, by the way. The capital of the nation of Jordan is even named, still named Ammon, which comes from Ammon. And most of those people are still there. He shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries in the land of Egypt, and all the other Arab nations will not escape that unbelievable war. But the nation that is now located where Edom once was, where much of Moab still is, and much of Ammon still is, shall be preserved. The question is, why preserve a whole nation? I thought the place of safety was only one little city. Well, you thought right. But God is going to preserve the major part of a tiny nation so we can build the place of safety into a magnificent city. And we've got to have some facilities. And we've got to have some help to do that. And I'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Now, why will God give stability and a certain amount of prosperity to that area called Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon for 3 long years, but not for the final 6 months? They'll cut off the center and the northern part of the country in the last 6 months and only protect the south where we, apparently, are going to be. Now, what about the idea of Petra? Back in the 50s, we used to talk about Petra all the time. You know, some of our members would go over there and they'd bring back little bottles of sand and hawk these bottles of sand at the Feast of Tabernacles and say, you know, $1.50 for a bottle of Petra sand. And we used to have to stock them. You know, people would go over there and try to make money off of selling Petra sand. What about Petra? I want to read something in a standard Bible dictionary. This is the InterVarsity Fellowship. And I want to read a little bit what they say about that city over in the Middle East called, we call Petra, page 1158.
I'll read you what they say, sort of interesting. Sila or Petra, anyone else knew the word Sila means a rock or a place that may be used in any rocky place. There is, however, a specific Sila in the Bible, which may now be identified with the massive rocky plateau also called El-Biara, which towers 1,000 feet above the level of Petra. And there originally was an Edomite settlement here. It was the capital, in fact, of the old nation of Edom, mentioned in Daniel 11. That nation, run by the Edomites, was finally taken over about 300 B.C. by the Nabataean Arabs, who converted the great valley of Petra, enclosed by mountain walls, into the amazing rock-cut city of Petra, the rose-red city, half as old as the dead. And the Nabataean Arabs did that after the Edomites left. They built Petra there.
Who are these Nabataean Arabs? I want to look up Nabataean. We'll just sort of read what it says about Nabataean Arabs, because 859, that's the page. We'll see who they were, and maybe we can come to some conclusions about where we'll be going. Nabataean Arabs, it took over from Edom. Notice what it says. The Nabataean Arabs were a nomadic Arabic tribe who didn't build houses or till the soil. They just wandered around, and that's what made them nomads. Their territory was the area south and east of the River Jordan, south and east, spreading the trade routes from the Orient to the Mediterranean. And their ancient capital was called Petra. Petra is 50 miles south of the Dead Sea. Petra was a stronghold for many, many hundreds of years. The Nabataean Arabs living in Petra began to cultivate the area because there is a rainy season. It is a howling wilderness when there's no rain, but there is some rain. With the skill of Nabataean engineers, they constructed irrigation systems. Oh, to conserve the scanty rainfall October through March. Rains a little bit. Many of their dams and reservoirs are still usable, in fact. They just need some repair. Well, that is very, very interesting. Who knows? Petra is surrounded by high cliffs pierced by narrow ravines which form an almost impregnable defense. And so it goes. Talk all about them. What happened to the Nabataean Arabs that did this? Well, the Nabataean people became absorbed in the surrounding Bedouin population, though the script continued to be used in the 4th century. They were absorbed into the surrounding population. The indication is, however, that they are still there. They just became a part of the local Arab population, and the local Arab population has the tradition that they have been there for some 2,000 years, if not more. And they're called Bedouins because they wander, and traditionally they claim to be descendants of the Nabataean Arabs. You ask the Bedouin there, who are your ancestors? They say, oh, our ancestors built Petra. They were the Nabataean Arabs. Now, was that significant? Turn to Isaiah chapter 42, and I'll show you that it is. But why is it significant? Isaiah 42 describes the coming of Jesus Christ and tells us, in a sense, where Jesus will find servants of his who will be singing, who will be serving him, who will rejoice when he returns. Isaiah 42, verse 1, my servant whom I uphold. It talks all about Christ's coming. Verse 10 says, sing unto the Lord a new song and his praise from the end of the earth, you that go down to the sea and all that is therein, the isles and the inhabitants thereof. Verse 11, now, talking about his return. Let the wilderness, let the desert. What desert? The desert off in Arizona, up in Victorville. Let the wilderness and the cities thereof lift up their voice. The villages that Kedar inhabits are to sing. Who is Kedar? I'll look at Kedar in my little handy Bible dictionary, because I'm sure it'll give me an answer. Kedar, in its restricted sense, denotes a nomadic tribe that inhabited the Arabian desert many hundreds of years ago. But the name is often used in the Bible and in rabbinical literature as a collective term for the Bedouin community in general. Now, the Arabs, called Nabataean Arabs, who live around Petra, call themselves Bedouin or Bedouin. And they live there some of the time, but they basically wander. And they view themselves as the descendants of the Nabataeans and as the descendants of Kedar. Let the area of the Middle East in which the Bedouin live rejoice. Let the inhabitants of Petra sing. Now, the Bedouin don't live in Petra. They go through there. They camp there. They graze their sheep there when there's some water, but they don't live in Petra. They live around that area. But here are people living in, and it says in the Hebrew language, let the inhabitants
of the city of Selah, let the inhabitants of Petra sing. Who is doing the singing? Those unconverted Bedouin with their flocks, or somebody else who happens to live, you see, in the area in which Kedar dwells? Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Oh, I mean, those mountains will still be standing where the Bedouin live. Hadn't you read that all the mountains are going to be flattened before Jesus comes? Hadn't you read in Revelation that all the mountains flee out of their place? That God will flatten the Alps and flatten the Rockies and there'll be unbelievable earthquakes? Yet here in the Middle East, in the area where a rather small, there are only a few thousands of them, Bedouin people live, there are mountains standing, and up on the top of those mountains that have not been flattened, people are singing, and in the middle of those mountains is the old city, the old Edomite capital called Petra. It is also standing and untouched by all of that seismic activity. The question is why? This is the southern end of the nation inhabited by Edom and Moab and the children of Ammon. Let them give glory unto God, verse 12, and declare his praise and his power. God will go forth as a mighty man. It's the time of his return. Isaiah chapter 33 talks about the area of Kedar as well. And I want you to notice what it says in Isaiah 33. Fascinating chapter. Isaiah 33. Very, very striking symbolism here. Verse 3, talking about the end of the age. Verse 3, at the noise of the tumult, someone's going to flee. At the lifting up of yourself, the nations are going to be scattered. Now, that isn't talking about one nation, but the whole world is going to be scattered, a time of awful worldwide tumult and of spoiling and of dying. And the end of the age in verse 5, someday Christ is going to dwell on high, but not quite yet. The earth is going to mourn and languish in verse 9. Talks about some Arab countries being destroyed, Lebanon as an example. Then, verse 13, hear you that are far off what I've done, and you that are near acknowledge my might. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Now, why are they afraid? Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who among us, they say, shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us will dwell with everlasting nuclear burnings? What they're saying, in effect, is who's going to survive? Who can survive this awful time? There's an answer here. Verse 15. He that walks righteously, a servant of God will, and speaks uprightly, he will survive. He that despises the gain of oppressions and shakes his hands from the holding of bribes, stops his ears from hearing of blood and shuts his eyes from seeing it. But the question then is where? In his house, at home, or someplace else? Verse 16 tells you where. He will dwell on high. That says in the mountains. Now Matthew 24 says, let him flee into the mountains. Which mountains? His place of safety, Isaiah said. That's what it says in the Hebrew. His place of defense shall be the fortress made out of rocks. Did you read that? The munitions, the Hebrew word is Masada, and it makes you think of Masada, you know, the old fortress where the Jews held out before the time of Christ, 70 B.C., when those Roman zealots came up, and millions of them, I think, if I remember it, died. It was awful at Masada. You go to Israel, you can visit Masada. It comes from Masad, which means a fortress. It says, he will dwell in the mountains, and his place of safety will be the fortress made of plural petras, made of selahs. Made out of rocks. Now, you build a fort in the USA, it's built out of what? Well, it's going to be built out of, you know, wood and the old forts. They could set fire to them because they would burn. They were burnable. This is a fortress made out of rocks. That's interesting. Made out of petras or selahs, plural. And bread will be given him there because there'll be no growing season at the beginning. We're going to have to create one. His water shall be sure. Now, the rainy season in Petra, in the desert, in the Negev, and in that part of Jordan, in the southern part in the Sinai, goes from about October through March, sort of like ours, a little longer, and they get about as much rain as we do. They do get some. And some of that beautiful desert, and it gets beautiful in about the month of January, will literally blossom like a rose for a few weeks, and you can catch the water, though, you see. But at the beginning, we will have insufficient water, but God says he will work it out so our waters are sure. That involves some miracles. But someday in that location, our eyes will see the king in his beauty. Where? We'll be in the munitions of rocks. When we see the eyes, with our eyes, Jesus Christ coming, they shall also behold the land that stretches afar off. Now that's a bad translation in the King James. It doesn't say the land that is very far off. It says quite the opposite. It says they'll be able to see the land, meaning Israel, Palestine, that stretches afar off. And from the heights of Petra, if that is the place, but this time I think you've begun to realize I do have fairly strong convictions that it is. But that's only 99%. It could be a type. Could be a type. You can create this into a type. You're a better man than I am, but it could be a type. Anyway, from those heights, God says, you can see the land of promise stretching afar off. We're going to go up there pretty often and look at that land and say, that's it. In a few years, we'll be in that land with Jesus Christ. Not here in this Arab land, in that land. Your heart will meditate the terror, verse 18, but you won't be living in it. And you'll be saying, where is the scribe? That is the military man who signs up the young soldiers, who enrolls them. Where is the receiver? That is the general who is the one that decides what tribute you bring. He's a military man. Where is he that counts the towers? That's the guy, the general, when there's going to be an attack, who counts literally the towers, who says, okay, here's the maneuver, the tactic we'll have to take that city. What he's saying is this, is you'll be able to see from the heights of the place of safety, military maneuvers, you see, off in the land of promise, but there'll be no maneuvers where you are. There'll be afar off. There'll be someplace else. You shall not see, verse 19, that fierce people there. That munitions of rocks will be untouched by those military massive armies that'll, you know, roll across the Middle East. You shall not see a fierce people, a people of a deeper speech and all that type of thing. We'll escape that. We'll see maneuvers. We will hear and maybe even see the MiGs and the Phantom jets screaming overhead, but they won't be able to drop bombs. We will see the rockets exploding at night. We'll see them exploding from the heights. Because the land that will stretch on beyond Jordan that we'll be able to see, you see, is going to be the site of some of the bloodiest battles in all the history of mankind. And untold millions will die over there. And we'll be able to see it, but it will not touch us where we will be. No bombs will drop there. Now, I said for 3 years, Jordan is going to be protected. And then for 6 months, only the southern end of the country where we are will be protected, but not the center and the north, because there's going to be an attack and God will remove his promise. And, you know, God will give that promise of protection to them for 3 years to give us time to build, to give us access to supplies and to building materials and to so many things I'll talk to you about in a minute. And they'll have a promise of protection for us and they'll be favorable towards us. God will work that out and we'll build. And they'll sell us vehicles, they'll sell us anything we need. I would imagine they'll help us construct the irrigation canals and the ditches and the basins and help us build homes. And it'll be a wonderful thing. And they'll be prospered because of us. But ultimately, brethren, God is going to withdraw his protection from them after we have built the most magnificent city. I am convinced of that on the face of the earth. God will cut off that lifeline with the populated center in the northern part of the nation of Jordan. And he will leave us, in a sense, to our own devices, but we'll have a lot of company because God says a lot of those Jordanians who helped us are going to be allowed to flee south where we are. We're going to have a big pack, maybe 30,000 unconverted Arabs, Jordanians, living with us in the place of safety for the last 6 months before Jesus Christ comes. I tend to think a lot of them are going to be converted during that period of time. Maybe there are reasons why God says in Kedar, all these people are rejoicing. And in the villages of Kedar, you see, people are singing when Jesus comes. I don't think they'll be right in there with us. I think they'll simply set up 10 villages in the area. Notice Isaiah 16, just an unbelievable, incredible scripture. Isaiah chapter 16. Actually, Isaiah 15 gives the context because the 15th chapter talks about the fall of Moab. Now, God in Daniel 11 said Moab would be protected, but he didn't say how long. It'd be about 3 years. Notice Isaiah chapter 15, verse 5. My heart will cry out for Moab because ultimately the promise of protection is removed. And his refugees will flee unto Zoar. That's where Lot went, but there'll be no protection in Zoar. They will flee ultimately into the true place of safety. And notice, he will be like a heifer of 3 years. What does that mean, 3 years? Chapter 16, verse 14. But now the Lord has spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of a hireling, and the glory of Moab shall be condemned. Now God is going to hire, in a sense, the Moabites to be our hosts and to help supply us with those needs that we have. And, you know, we'll have favor with them. They'll help us build to some degree. And ultimately, if you notice chapter 16, verse 1, they'll be in the area of Petra. Now, the Moabites are in the central part of the country and the north. But here, as Jesus returns to the earth, you find them in the south. Chapter 16, verse 1. What are they doing in the south? Well, they're in the south because that's where we are, you see, brethren. And they'll be living in the tents and the villages of Kedar. Chapter 16. We're going to tell them this someday, and a lot of them are going to respond. Send you a lamb. That's a symbol of tribute and a thanksgiving to Jesus. When he comes, here are these Arabs, and you'll see these are Moabites, and they'll be living where? Send it to the ruler of the land. That's Jesus Christ, who'll rule the world, in fact, but that land too. It's going to be sent. A lamb is going to be sent from Sela, it says Petra, is going to be sent, you see, through the wilderness, across Jordan, under the mount of the daughter of Zion. Now, why do you have these Moabites from the central part of Jordan down in Petra, which is in the south, and that isn't their land at all? And as Jesus comes, they're sending tribute to him across the desert to Jerusalem and saying, in effect, we want to be submissive to you. Is it because a lot of them may have been converted as a result of contact with us? Question, I'm not sure of that. It shall be as a wandering bird cast out of his nest. So the daughters of Moab, central and northern Jordanians, shall be at the forge of Arnon, they're fleeing south. And God says this to them as they flee. Take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. As you flee, he said, be careful that you're not seen. They're going south, and God says to them as they flee south, make your shadow as the night. Even though you flee at noon, make sure you can't be seen. As the armies, the Russian armies, surge across northern and central Jordan, he said, don't let those armies see where you're going as you flee south. Why? Because you'll see in a minute, south, in the southern part of the nation, there are other refugees, there are other outcasts, and you find the outcasts of Moab are to protect the outcasts of the living God, the refugees, those who have already fled there, and there are two groups of people who will flee into southern Jordan. Notice verse 4 says, let my outcasts dwell with you, Moab, when you become an outcast. You have two groups, God's outcasts and the outcasts of the nation of Moab. And when does this occur? He says you're to be a cover to them, verse 4, from the face of the spoiler. The executioner is at an end. The spoiler ceases. The oppressors are consuming out of the land. In mercy shall the throne be established. That's when Jesus Christ comes. So after the 3 years, you see, protection is removed. And in the last few months, they flee south. Now, who's the invader of Moab? Who begins to surge across that part of the world? You need to understand this because I'll show you something in a minute. Then we'll close a couple of minutes after that. Ezekiel chapter 25, you'll see that Jordan is going to be invaded by massive Oriental communist armies in the north and in the center, but not in the south. Not in the south. Chapter 25. Remember, the communists will come into the land of Israel, where the Europeans will be in charge, from two directions, from the north out of Russia to the northern border from Lebanon, but they'll also come from the east, and the communist hordes of China and someday of Japan and of Vietnam and of India will roll across Iraq and Iran, and they'll join them, and then they'll surge, you see, across the southern end of Syria and across the northern end of Jordan into the land of Israel to take the city of Jerusalem from the east. Now, when that happens, we'll know it. When that time comes, we'll know it, because suddenly thousands of Arabs will be fleeing south to escape those armies, and we'll find them knocking on our door, and we'll be saying, you can't come in where we are, but you can make villages all around us, because God will protect you here. Ezekiel 25, verse 1, son of man, verse 2, set your face against the Ammonites. Well, we're going to preach this to them someday. Ammon is the capital of Jordan. We're going to set our face against them. Some of you may even drive on up to Ammon someday. Maybe Mr. Armstrong will do this. And we'll say, okay, this is going to happen to you someday. Verse 3, say to the Ammonites, hear the word of the Eternal, thus says the Eternal God, because you set a ha against my sanctuary. That was the sanctuary in Jerusalem, when the Jewish place of worship is profane, and they laughed. They didn't mind. And against the land of Israel, our nations, when our nations go captive. And against the house of Judah, when the Europeans literally blitz the nation into smithereens, and the Jordanians say, serves them right, because you see a lot of Palestinians live in Jordan, and they're no great lovers of the Jews. Now they'll love us. God will work that out, but not the Jews. Therefore, behold, I'll deliver you, verse 4, into the hands of the men of the east for possession. That'll happen in those last few months after those 3 years of protection have been removed. And I will make Rabbah a stable for camels, verse 5, and they'll be destroyed, verse 7. I'll deliver you into their hands. And it'll happen, verse 8, to Moab and to Seir. I'll open the sides of of Moab from the cities, and I will deliver Moab, verse 10, unto the men of the east, these 200 million strong communist hordes rolling across that part of the Middle East to take Jerusalem from the eastern side, across the West Bank. And so it goes. The men of the east, verse 10, will have that possession. Now, will some of them survive? Can some of them flee? Where will they go if some of them flee? This is going to happen, and most of the population is up in the north where it does happen. Go to Jeremiah chapter 48. Jeremiah chapter 48, verse 1, it is going to happen, and some of them will flee, and God says they can. He doesn't say stay in your cities and die, as these massive communist armies literally destroy and devastate all of northern and central Jordan and wipe the city of Ammon off the face of the map. Most people will have helped us to some degree. And God gives them a special blessing. Chapter 48, verse 1, against Moab, you, thus says the Eternal Host, the God of Israel, woe unto Nebo, that's in the north, and unto Kirianathan, it's confounded. And there shall be no more praise of Moab, verse 2, and Heshbon, they've devised evil against it. Verse 3 of Jeremiah 48, a voice of crying shall be heard from Horonaim, spoiling and great destruction. Moab is destroyed, her little ones have caused a cry to be heard. Now what do we say to them? Verse 6, flee, save your lives, and be like the heath in the wilderness. Verse 8, the spoiler comes to Moab. Verse 9, give wings unto all of these carnal Arabs, wings, that they may flee and get away, for the cities thereof shall be desolate with none to dwell therein. And where does God say they should flee? Verse 28, O you that dwell in Moab in those last few months, leave the cities and go and dwell in Petra. Go and dwell in Shelah. Go and dwell in the rock. Well, they know what that means. If we go up to a mountain and say, flee, and it says literally in Hebrew, go and dwell in Petra, brethren, every Jordanian knows exactly where Petra is. It's the only big tourist site in the whole country. You know, right now they're building an airport in Petra, near Petra, because they want to bring in tourists. The Jordanian government has spent thousands of dollars to clean up Petra, to clean out the caves, because it's a tourist site. They got one other dinky site north of Amman. They want tourist dollars and tourist francs and tourist pounds. They know where Petra is. You say to somebody in Amman, flee to Petra, he doesn't say, oh, where's that? He knows where it is. They'll also know where we are. Notice, and where are they going to live? They'll be like a dove making her nest in the sides of the cliff, in the little holes in the cliff. This is a type of caves. There'll be a lot of room there. One time there was 120,000 people in Petra, and they'll be in that area. Well, you come to your own conclusions, brethren. I've come to mine. Now, I don't have time to tell you what the two signs are that'll tell us to flee. I'm going to give a sermon in a couple of weeks on the Jews and prophecy and how God has worked with the Jews. And you'll see that the sign to flee is all interinvolved with the Jews. What they do and a temple they're going to build, at least a holy place, maybe another temple. And I want to talk about that, and you'll see what those two signs are. But before I close, and I won't go into that today, I want to discuss briefly what we'll be doing in Petra or wherever the location is, because we'll be doing so much. We're going to build a city. You know why we have so many people working construction in the Church of God? You know why 90% of our brethren in San Bernardino that are men, male, work in construction? You know why about 30% here do? Go into our congregations all across the U.S. and every, you say to a guy, oh, what's your job? Well, I put up drywall. What's your job? I'm a carpenter. What's your job? Well, you know, I'm a cabinet maker. Any reason why God calls all these people that work, you see, in construction, and all the engineers and a lot of teachers? Reasons for that. We're going to build a city. We're going to build a city. Now, we'll rough it for a while. When we arrive, there aren't going to be any Sealy Posturepedic mattresses, you know, sitting around in those caves. But, you know, there are mattress factories in Amman. The mattresses will come. Now, your back is going to hurt for a couple of months. I can promise you that, but you'll survive it okay, but it won't be long until those things come. Houses and everything of the kind, there won't be a lot of fresh food when we arrive. Fresh food and that type of thing. But God can, you know, work that out. He can cause manna to come down from heaven supernaturally. Or he can cause somebody else to put the food there for us. You know, I could tell you all about what the evangelicals are doing. They think that the woman in Revelation chapter 12 are the Jews. They don't know the woman is the church, because evangelicals all teach and say that, you know, the church goes to heaven before the tribulation comes. That's the rapture. And the church is gone during the tribulation, they say. They're wrong. But that's what they believe. But here's the scripture in Revelation 12 that says, the woman flees into her place on the earth. And you ask the evangelicals, well, what does that mean? If we're already raptured, who is this woman? And she's on the earth. And they look puzzled. They've looked puzzled for years about that scripture. You know, they have no answer. It just conflicts with the idea of going to heaven for 3.5 years. So finally they come up with the answer, well, those are the Jews. The Jews will flee when the tribulation begins, and they'll be in Petra. And they literally say Petra. They've come up with that too. I can prove the Jews won't flee to Petra. It's easy to prove. But I want you to notice a little comment. This is a man named Chuck Smith that he wrote about Petra, and he's an evangelical. He made a comment in Revelation 12 on the woman. Sort of interesting. The place in the wilderness described in Revelation 12, he writes, is actually the ancient rock city of Petra. Very good. I'll give him an A for that. Where the Jews will flee, give him an F for that, during the last 3.5 years. Petra is an impregnable fortress, well, not quite as much as he thinks, that lies back in the Havra Valley in Jordan, south of the Dead Sea. In Isaiah, God declares that Sela, which is Petra, will be the place of shelter for the Jews. He does not, but he doesn't know any better. He's got to answer in somehow, you know, the dichotomy between Revelation 12 and Isaiah and what he believes about the rapture. God commands those in Jordan to open their doors and to receive his people. Very good. To get them sheltered till the indignation be passed. Very good. Knowing this, this is very good too, some Christian businessmen have gone to the rock city of Petra and have stored tons of food in the caves. When the Jews finally flee to the wilderness, they'll find ample food supplies there. The caves are also well furnished with tracts in Hebrew bearing witness of Jesus Christ. Well, we'll make bonfires out of those tracts. But we will eat the food. I don't know how much they've done. I think it's sort of interesting. They don't know what they've done. But it's there. It's dried, and it'll probably feed us for a while. Time enough to get our engineers in the church out repairing those irrigation basins to get the water down between October and March, and then begin to see plant gardens. Brethren, 40 miles away from Petra in the Negev, the Israelis have built beautiful towns with 40, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 population in the exact same kind of desert, and they've gotten the water basins in there. They have irrigated, and that desert can blossom like a rose, because you look across that border from Jordan into Israel, and the Jews have done exactly that. If the Jews can do it, we can do it. We've got the engineers. The water supply isn't great, but at one time 130,000 Arabs lived in that city 2,000 years ago, and they had sufficient water to do it, and we will do it. Energy sources? Ever heard of solar energy? Who needs energy? We'll have all the sun we need to produce energy. And if you like to dabble in energy, and you know, we've got all these crazy members in the church that are always getting involved in solar things. Boy, I'm glad they're around. I really am glad we got these crazy members who want to experiment and invent and get involved in solar energy. We'll need you. That's why you're around, by the way, one reason. You see, we've got all these members in the Church of God worldwide. We've got, you have no idea the potential we've got. So we get to that place of safety. We begin to say, okay, all the engineers, put your hands up. Well, all these hands go up. All the carpenters, put your hands up. And we bring in by the truckload all these Jordanian-made tools. We say, get out there and build us a city. We don't want to live in these caves for the next 3.5 years. Build us a city. And you will build us a city, brethren, the likes of which this earth has never seen. You think Ambassador College looks nice? Where do you see the place of safety after 3.5? That's a long time. The Israelis built beautiful towns in 1 year out of nothing in the desert in a year. They built functional, nice little houses, prefabs. They look good. I'm not even sure we'll settle with prefabs. Maybe we'll want the real stuff from the ground on up. We'll see. We got the farmers. We got the experts in irrigation. We've got so much expertise in this church. It isn't even funny. You know, you bump into members all the time and say, boy, I'm just a carpenter. What can I do in the kingdom of God with my carpentry ability? They look sort of puzzled. And my reaction is, don't worry about the kingdom of God. What are you going to do in that place of safety with your carpentry ability? Now, I don't have any. I'm no carpenter. I can't, you know, I nail something in, it goes through my hand. You got it. And you know, when Jesus Christ comes, it's sort of interesting. I want you to turn to Ezekiel chapter 20. I'll keep you over just a couple of minutes here. And Ezekiel chapter 20 says, when Jesus comes, all the Israelites and the Jews who have gone as refugees worldwide will be brought back into the wilderness where Petra is. When Jesus comes, we'll be in the wilderness. We'll rise to meet him. We'll rejoice. And then we'll go to Jerusalem to build another city. But you see, before all these unconverted Israelites are allowed to go into Jerusalem and to live in that land and to resettle it, they're going to have to go through a time of, let's call it, debriefing and re-education. And God says that will happen in the wilderness, and he will not allow them in the land until they have come under the rod of the covenant. So they come into that wilderness, and what are they going to find there? Well, Isaiah said they will find a city, they will find people rejoicing, and those mountains will still be standing. They will not have been knocked down, and a city will have been built, and we're going to take people into that city, and we're going to re-educate them before they go into the land of promise. And they'll walk across, once they're ready, they'll walk across that 20 miles of desert, you see, to the River Jordan. And they'll walk across the River Jordan exactly as our ancestors did thousands of years ago. They walked out of that wilderness, across the desert, across Jordan, into the land of promise. And that is going to happen again. Ezekiel chapter 20. No time to go into all of this. As I live, verse 33 says, the eternal God, I'm going to rule over you someday with fury poured out. That's tribulation. Verse 34. of Ezekiel 20, and I will bring you out from among the people and will gather you out of all the countries where you're scattered with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm. This is after Jesus comes. And where will they go? Directly back into the land of Palestine. No, they're going to be re-educated first. And we're going to have a rehabilitation center all ready for them. You know, with fresh toilets and little houses and stores and churches. They're not going to walk, you know, Jerusalem will lie in rubble when the kingdom of God comes. It'll all have to be rebuilt from the ground up. But one city will be left on the face of this earth that will not lie in rubble. Every other city will have been virtually destroyed. In Africa, the Middle East, Europe, they'll lie in rubble. One will not lie in rubble. One will not. I will bring you, verse 35, into the wilderness of the people. That is Sinai. And there in that wilderness where we will have spent 3.5 years, will I plead with you face to face. That'll last many weeks. Many weeks, in many cases. As I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness in the land of Egypt. Same wilderness, same place. Same way, so will I plead with you once again and teach you and rehabilitate you and debrief and prepare. And then I'll cause you, verse 37, to pass under the rod and will bring you into the bond of the covenant. And I'll purge out the rebels from among you, and I will bring them forth out of the countries where they sojourn, and they shall not go into the land of Israel first. They will go into the wilderness of the people. That's where we will have been. Brethren, when you rise in clouds to meet Jesus Christ as he returns, people say, where will our kids be? You know, during the marriage supper, well, they'll be in the most beautiful city in the face of the earth, the only city in the face of the earth left standing. Maybe they'll work with some of the refugees there for a while. I don't know. Now, I could go into all these things and spend hours on it, but time is up, and I just can't do that. I just want you to remind you one thing before we close. One scripture. You can turn to the book of Psalms, chapter 91. I'll read that in a minute. I want to submit a few disarming facts to you about the city of Petra, if that be the location, and I would think it is. But again, this could be a type. That chance is always there. It could be a type. Without God, the place of safety would not be a place of safety. It would be a place of death. You see, it is a terrible mistake to place too much emphasis on what we can do and what the church can do. We've got all this talent. We'll draw on it. But even with all the talent and the expertise to build and to change and to promote and to educate, we still must have the living God with us. He is our rock. Now, Petra is a rock. A rock city. But the Bible says God is our rock. He is the rock. He is the rock of our salvation. And that rock city would be a place of death and dying for a group as big as this, without God being with us and God being there, brethren. A couple of facts. Petra is vulnerable to attack. A helicopter can land in Petra anytime it wants to. Petra can be attacked from the air, and a MiG or a Phantom jet can streak over Petra, strafe the city, and kill everybody in that area. What will keep those jets away from that place of refuge? God will. God will place a cover over us. He will be like a covert. The tanks can get into Petra. Sure they can. It's not impregnable. The heat is terrible in the daytime, and it's terribly cold at night, and there are scorpions there, and they're poisonous. What would keep the scorpions from biting us and killing us? You know, what I'm trying to say is this. Petra is not a place of safety without God. We'll be only a few miles from some of the most horrendous battles ever to be fought in all the history of mankind. And we will hear the bombs being dropped, brethren. We will hear them. The whole land of Jordan will literally shake as those armies pour across from the east. The city of Jerusalem is going to be virtually wiped off the face of the map. And from the peaks of Petra, you can see some of the skyscrapers, the big buildings in Jerusalem, about 95 miles to the northwest. We'll hear it. We'll hear the rockets. Now, Petra without God would be a tomb. He's our rock, and he will protect us there. Or, if it is another location, and Petra is only a type, he will protect us in that other location. Psalms 91 to close. General promise, but it certainly applies to that time that's ahead of us. Chapter 91, verse 1, he that dwells in the secret place of the Most High, that's an interesting phrase, shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. Under his shadow, we'll need that shadow. Remember the Israelites, because it was so hot in that desert. It is a howling wilderness. They had at night, because it got so cold, they had a flame of fire at night to keep them warm. You see, the heat came down from that flame of fire. In the daytime, when it got 120 degrees in the shade, they had a cloud over top of them as they wandered to, you know, filter out some of those hot, hot rays of the sun. Do you believe it'll happen again? You don't have to believe it, but I believe it. We will dwell under the shadow of the Almighty. He will warm us at night. He will cool us off in the day. And I'll say of the Lord, he's my refuge and my fortress. He is my fortress will be in a masad, in a fortress made out of the rock. The one in whom we must trust, not in the rock, but in God. He'll deliver us from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome disease. He'll cover us with his feathers, and under his wings shall we trust. We will not be afraid for the terror by night. We'll see the rockets overhead. Maybe we'll hear the sound of the MiGs and the Phantom jets. But none of it will affect us. Notice what it says. Verse 7, 1,000 will fall at our side and 10,000 at our right hand, but it shall not come near us. That is, it'll be fairly close, but it won't be near us. We'll be able to see it happening from the peaks and look out and know what is occurring just a few miles away. Petra's about 19 miles from the border of Jordan and Israel, from the Jordan River. It will not come nigh us. With our eyes, we may behold it. If we climb to the peaks and look on beyond into the land of promise, we will see the reward of the wicked. Because you've made the eternal, which is my refuge, even the Most High, your habitation. We will dwell with him, and he'll be with us in safety. There shall therefore no evil befall us. Neither shall any plague come nigh our dwelling. He'll give his angels charge over us, and they'll bear us up in their hands. Lest you dash your foot against what? Against a Petra, against a stone, against a Selah, against a rock. You shall tread upon the lion and the scorpions and the poisonous things that are over there. Will not be affected by it. Why? Because he has set his love upon us, and God will deliver us and lift us up on high and give us his name. And then it says we'll have his salvation. He will be with us. And it's going to be, in a sense, a frightening time, but at the same time, an exciting time. The scriptures and the word of God say that the eternal will take us into a place of safety. And brethren, the lesson we must remember is this. As we come down to the closing years of this age, you must think and remember what happened to Lot's wife. That's a memorial for us. Remember Lot's wife. She didn't flee. She didn't want to go. She was not protected. Lot was. As it was in the days of Lot and in the days of Noah, so shall it be once again in the days of the...